And we are back, picking up here with Patrick Hennison from 21stCenturyWire.com. Welcome back, everybody. We are talking, of course, about Ukraine, Crimea, and we have much more to talk about here in the second. We have a couple other points we want to get to a little bit later here. But basically, let's talk a little bit more about the situation and see if there's anything else to add to this as well, Patrick. Because what do you how do you think this will unfold then from this point and forward? Both in terms of Crimea, but also the bigger situation in Ukraine and everything else. And a little bit later, I wanted to ask you a bit more about the leaked phone calls and what you think actually happened there and how they got leaked. I'm always interested in how things just kind of get out and in the way they do. But Crimea, future in Ukraine, anything more to add there?
Yeah, I think what we're looking at quite obviously here is really the West, Western countries, the NATO countries, mainly we're talking about, but consolidating power, reconsolidating power, because there is a need for a visible enemy in order to make NATO relevant. NATO should have been disbanded years ago, okay? And they've stretched way, way beyond their remit. They're in Afghanistan. They want to sign up Japan. You know, is the North Atlantic Treaty Organization had a specific purpose anyway at the time, which was to, you know, halt the advancement or to contain Soviet satellite influence in Eastern Europe from moving westward, and to really secure the structural integrity of Western Europe at the time, so that it's redundant. And it's now used as a sort of facade in order to, by stealth, really carry out military operations in places that no country could go unilaterally. But under the NATO remit in that collective, they seem to be able to get away with it. Libya is a perfect example. But it's really about reconsolidating power and creating fear in the public that there is a potential conflict or a potential enemy, mainly in Russia and also China, to throw in there as well. But in order to secure spending on defense for the next 30, 40, 50 years, that is all this is, essentially. And on the opportunistic side, behind all these big defense contractors, you have some of the people who actually own large chunks of them, which are private banks, and also the monetary system that they're propping up. They're running out of basically black holes to pour paper into. And the Ukraine offers an opportunity for a short-term fix to basically infect that economy with debt and hopefully see some negative ripple effects economically, whereby the vultures, the financial vultures and the predators, can come in and pick up the carcasses for nothing that are laying around dying, the economic carcasses. So Ukraine is basically an ungovernable, dysfunctional, failed state, essentially is what it is now. Economically, it's a failed state, and it's completely at the mercy now of the international banking syndicate. And all the politicians in the West did was just basically beat the door down to allow them to come through that door. And behind the banks become the transnational corporations. I believe that there is large plans already in place to hopefully frack the Ukraine in the future with hydraulic fracturing, which would be devastating to their environment, to their water supply and everything else, which we're finding out in Britain, in America, and Australia, the horrors of that particular industry, which is, again, a short-term fix, which is, basically a kind of fiat industry that's a loser in the long term, but it allows some money to change hands and some millions and billions to be made in the short term. But that's essentially what that whole thing is about. The benefits of this, of course, on the top level are that if you can create a binary, bipolar, reinvigorate the bipolar world that we saw in the Cold War, that pretty much will guarantee or give some justification for blank check spending in terms of upgrading nuclear arsenals, and increasing, global satellite surveillance and high-tech military applications that otherwise, in a world that's moving on a road towards a peaceful relationships with the major powers wouldn't be possible. And people say, well, that's a very cynical way of looking at it. Well, I'm sorry to say that that's reality, that people are naive to think that the sort of, you know, corporations we're talking about and the people in charge and the shareholders and the politicians who are in their pockets of these lobbies would not sell, you know, they'd sell their grandmother into slavery for a dollar.
Right.
If they thought that they could stick that in their pocket. That's the value level, the basic value levels that we're talking about with these individuals. So that is the world, that is the upper layer, the upper fascist industrial layer is a domain that is really exclusive to people who can work in that environment. And you have to be sociopathic and psychopathic to be able to navigate and to succeed in that environment. And therefore the decision making, the agendas are very irrational, very short term, very inflammatory, very fear based. And that's the world that they operate in. And they want us to adopt some of those values. They want us to almost sympathize with them.
Right.
And on the really, really dark, putrid scale of this sort of mentality is that when they project back to the people, let's say in America, to certain communities or states saying, well, you need the defense industry because of it's supplying 10,000 jobs in this state, you know, in Arizona or in Southern California. So, you know, if you're not going to support, the expansion of defense, then you're going to lose all these jobs and it's going to create an economic recession in your area. That is the really, really hardcore, cynical end of that spear that goes to the local level. So from start to finish, all this is reinvigorating something that the world thought they put behind us. And these individuals want to pull us back to the 1970s after we've made quite a bit of progress forward. And the people like you, people like me, the people you meet in the street, the people you interact with, you can go and meet and have great relationships with Russian people. And you couldn't do that 30 years ago. Okay.
Yeah.
Eastern European, Eastern Germany people, people from Poland, people from Czech Republic, people from Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, all great, great people, great young people. And they want to pull us back into a point where that's all been kind of, yanked back. And they want us to fear and think that Russia's wanting to expand all over Europe and all this stuff. You cannot compare Russia with the United States, okay? And anybody who even attempts to do that, all I'm going to say to them is, let's do the math. Let's look at the numbers here. How many bases does Russia have globally outside of its own borders? What, maybe 10?
Right.
12? How many does the U.S. have? 3,000 installations,
right,
globally,
yeah,
and big operations all over the globe. And to keep that whole party going, they need to have some sort of a reason. They need existential threats, and they're constantly
exactly.
having to constantly having to generate them. And if you can't see that, and you think that somehow that your biggest threat is now Vladimir Putin, just because he's been characterized in the Western media as this sort of hitman, you know, straight out of the Men from U.N.C.L.E. and you buy that, and you think that for that feeling, that gut feeling you have that he's a bad man, then you're going to back the reinvigorating of the Cold War, then you really have failed intellectually, historically, educationally. You've learned nothing. All the blood that's been shed in Afghanistan, in Iraq, how many Iraqis have died since Gulf War I?
Millions,
what,
right?
What are we talking about? By some people's estimation, 1.5 in total, 2 million in Afghanistan. I don't know what the numbers are, but they're well in excess of a quarter of a million. You add all these things together and you get into some very, very big numbers and a lot of civilians, women and children, absolutely slaughtered whole families, generations of families. And who has done that at the end of whose bullet, at the end of whose gun, at the end of the United States' gun, at the end of a British gun, a French gun, NATO gun, okay? To sit here and say that there's any equivalent at all with regards to the ambitions of the West, of the Anglo-Americans, of the Trilateralists, of the Bilderbergers, and to compare that to the ambitions of what Russian national interests are, is an outrageous comparison. And let me also add to this, that area, Ukraine, Crimea, that area in southern Russia, how much blood was spilt? How much blood was spilt in the Second World War?
Oh, yeah.
While the Soviet Union, while Joseph Stalin's armies were fighting alongside the Allied forces, lost 20 million people.
Mm.
Now, let's compare that to how many the British lost, 400,000 in the Second World War. United States, 350, maybe 400, including the Pacific War Theater with Japan. Let's say 500,000, okay? 20 million. The whole of the Allied casualties combined do not even come close to what Russia sacrificed, what the Soviet Union sacrificed to keep out the very people with the very same ideas, the Nazis, the fascists, the neo-fascists, to keep them out of their section, of their land, what they gave up in blood, and if you understand that, you understand how sensitive this issue is for Russians, and for Ukrainians too.
Yeah.
So for the Russian who knows his history, to look at how the EU and these technocrats in Brussels and these, people from the State Department like Victoria Nuland to coming over, doing what they're doing, and to look at that and see who they're backing, like Svoboda Party people, neo-Nazi right sector, swastika-wearing, marching, armband-wearing people, and see them allying with them and looking at your history and how many generations Russians were wiped off during the Second World War because defending that turf. And you have to look at that and you know exactly what you're seeing, okay? You're seeing the EU essentially doing this in a representative way, exactly what was being done in the Second World War. That's why it's sensitive. And if you can't understand that, if you're American or European, you can't put yourself in Russia's shoes there and see that, then you're pretty much hopeless and you're at the mercy of whatever propaganda is being spewed out and pumped into your brain over this so-called crisis.
Yeah, war is a racket, as I said, and a tremendous amount of young men has died on all sides and both sides. And you know, just even the basic idea, though, that the Allied won, you know, the good war and the idea that the before or after that point, there wasn't any kind of propaganda fought by the Allied forces or the West. It's just like you can't just isolate an event in history and say it just sprung out of nowhere. These are just consequential, long-term, cyclical periods that we're moving through, and things bubble up to the surface again, and that's just how it's going to be, you know. And it's I think, again, we make a grave mistake to try to judge it on an issue by issue basis on these kinds of events, at least, you know, because there's just so much antagonistic sentiments behind it. But how do you think there is a moving forward from that kind of situation, though? Is there any way to solve this thing? We know that, as you explained, the psychopathic element to this are, of course, playing on this all the time to instigate more war, instigate more conflict. The more chaos there is, the more reason it is for them to be in charge and try on their own level, their own psychopathic level, to offer the solutions to these very problems, to offer the control in these chaotic times, so to speak. But is there a way that we could nestle a way out of this and just try to maintain some kind of stability? What do you think, Patrick?
I think it's difficult to say, but I believe that the disconnect between the political leadership, and when I say political leadership, especially in the West, and everywhere, even China and Russia, The political behind the political leadership is the real power, and this is a corporate power, and the banking powers. That's all our politicians represent. They represent. They don't represent the interests, especially on a foreign policy level. Okay, don't even fall for this anymore, and most people don't, but they represent the interests of those banking syndicates and those transnational corporations. And whatever comes out of their mouth is basically coming out of the mouth of Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, or Raytheon. Okay. It's not the voice of the American people or the people of Europe.
Yeah,
the people
exactly.
of Belgium or the people of Holland or France or Britain. It's not. Okay. So the more this disconnect, this gulf between the people and the political leadership extends, and it's extending every day. The establishment then has to double down. They have to double down on the security state. They have to double down on repression, because that gap is just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And at some point, you have a permanent disconnect, and that is when it's going to be very difficult for the detached political class to govern. Because they no longer have the only tool they have right now to get the consent of the people is coercion, is fear. Okay, and at some point that has to reverse, because otherwise they won't be in power. And the sad part is, you know, if destabilization happens in Western Europe or in America, whoever is attempting to come up through the grassroots to reform the situation is going to have to go against the banking syndicates and these corporations, and that's not an easy fight.
No.
So it's I dare say it's not an easy situation to reform or to correct. But what I do think is that overall the amount of people who are politically aware, who are awake, will vastly outnumber those who are trying to subjugate it into whatever that policy or agenda is. And that is just inevitable. And it's, I don't think you can turn back that tide. It's already starting to form, and it's just really a question of time. But there are no guarantees. You're not guaranteed any rights.
No. Of course not.
You're not guaranteed freedom of speech.
Nope.
You're not guaranteed freedom of the press. You will always have to fight for it.
That's right.
And you'll always have to beat them back. And throughout history, people have had to do that, and that will never stop. And you'll never get a perfect system. It'll always be a fight to manage that system. It's like if you move into you see couples or people all the time when they're on the property ladder, and they find, say, this is the house, this is my dream house, and I'm finally happy. You move into the house, this is the one, this is the perfect house, this is the perfect community, the perfect town. Then you move in and you realize, oh, the plumbing's leaking. Well, that wasn't there when I bought it. We've got to fix that. Oh, my neighbors are basically you know, tearing up my garden, or my neighbor's dog, or something's wrong in the village, and there's some corruption.
Yep.
You have this vision that one day that everything will be perfect. It just doesn't exist. You constantly have to work it, you know, reorganize, move things, change things, recalibrate your planning.
Utopia is a fantasy, you know, people have to get that into their head, and also just realize in that process that's not a negative thing. There are, I mean, when mankind is pushed to the brink, when mankind is challenged the most, that's when we do extraordinary things. This is not a bad idea. I think that the complacency that would come about if there was a system that were to nullify all the conflicts and issues, if you will, or if we managed to bring something in that would kind of make people content with the system, a utopia, if you will, that would be to the greatest detriment of mankind ever, and we would fall way, way, way behind in our development and things that we even invented, the way people think about new things, new ideas, and all those things, right? So I've just dropped that ball altogether and said that, like, times of great strife and problematic issues is actually a friend of ours. It's not our enemy, right?
Absolutely. But the one thing that we can, the one battle that we can fight and can be victorious in, I believe, at least at least winning the battles. Winning the war is another matter altogether. But in terms of during your lifetime winning the battles, this battle that goes on psychologically, that is a battle that can be won. Okay.
Yeah.
It's, you know, in a political sense, it's not just, it's much, much more than just a struggle to shape what politicians would call public opinion or what media would call public opinion. This is a battle for reality itself. It's a psychic, spiritual reality battle.
Yeah.
And you have to decide if you're going to be, you know, if you want to live in reality or if you want to live in the illusory world or the Hollywood world. And at some point, you know, sadly, at some point in modern history, our revered watchdog became a lapdog. Okay,
exactly.
That's not an exaggeration.
No, of course not.
The international corporate media and all the editors, producers, and journalists are literally collared like dogs.
Everything has its time, right?
Yeah. So, you know, we need to work to rebirth the press. The word press comes from Gutenberg's printing press. And that even back in 1400s, when Gutenberg invented the printing press, he was targeted by monarchs, by barons, by industrialists, you know, by bureaucrats. They wanted to shut down printing, or they wanted to, the church was after him. Mm-hmm. Everybody was after him.
Yeah.
They wanted, and so the printing press, the movable type, eventually gave way to mass publishing, and that could be corporatized and controlled, which gave way to digital publishing, which couldn't be controlled initially, and they're trying to control it now. Mm. This is a fight. So this is, you know, the Pandora's box of interactive and highly mobile, real-time, superhighway, multimedia, social media syndication. That box opened.
And that works both ways, by the way, as we clarified before, you know.
Yeah, so it's advancing rapidly, you know, and it might, for some people, it might seem like a full-time job just to keep pace with it. But, you know, for our governments and their transnational corporate sponsors, it's a full-time obsession to try to control it. So what happened is that the Fourth Estate, the press was once regarded with the term the Fourth Estate, as a part of society that was equal to the church, equal to government. It was a necessary element in a functioning, free social democracy, was the Fourth Estate. And at some point in recent history, that Fourth Estate has become a fifth column and working against society. That's what we have now. And that fifth column is an international corporate pyramid, which masquerades as media and press with the governments in tow behind it. That's the fifth column. The Fourth Estate became a fifth column. And it is actually working against the interests of the average Joe. And that is the problem right now. So they are creating their reality and hoping to create your reality. And you can do something about that by where you choose and what ideas you choose to take on board. And we still live, there's still some egalitarian freedom with regards to the internet, and you have to use it. If you don't use it, you most certainly will lose it.
Very good. Now, let's talk about the news anchor then that quit. It's kind of, it's obviously related to this issue of the Russian situation and Crimea and everything else. Liz Vall from the RT channel, and the relationship with her good friend James Kirkpatrick from the Foreign Policy Initiative. It seems then interesting that they managed to nestle their way into RT, and it also kind of shows a little bit how, I guess, how difficult it is to vet people before they go in. But her interviews that she did consequently with, you know, Fox, I think she's been on CNN, is just taking this as a immense career opportunity amongst, you know, all the criticism that she has received just for the drama of it. But she doesn't seem very, very bright, to be honest, you know.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, listening to Liz Waugh, and, you know, take the teleprompter away, and she has to answer questions. It's a totally different ballgame for any news anchor these days. But she was an RT presenter. She'd been with RT America for about 2.5 years, and no protests, no ideological stances during that time. And all of a sudden, she comes on air, I believe it was March 4th or 5th, and makes this dramatic announcement that she is resigning from RT because she can't sit back and work for a network that whitewashes the actions of Putin, specifically with regards to the Crimea. Now, the timing of her PR stunt, and we know it's a PR stunt because Max Blumenthal from Truthdig did an extensive investigation and report, which was published last week, which basically showed that this wasn't a spontaneous resignation or some big act of conscience. This is something that was planned months ahead. Well, it turns out that Liz Wall looks to it, to me, it appears that she was a willing accomplice, and she allowed herself to be used by a neoconservative think tank called the Foreign Policy Initiative in Washington, D.C., and they're called FPI for short. But FPI is basically a rebrand of the Project for a New American Century.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so Foreign Policy Initiative is really run by Robert Kagan and William Kristol. These are two of the architects of everything from 9/11 to the Afghanistan war to the Iraq war. Okay, these are the people who Liz Waugh is getting her direction from. And the middleman, his name is James Kirkuk, and he's, you know, a 30-year-old neoconservative LGBT activist stroke journalist who looks like he would probably write, or, you know, for anybody really, if the money was right. But
right.
He became friends with Liz Waugh behind the scenes when he hijacked a program about when they're on RT, they're debating about Bradley Manning in the Manning trial. James Kirkuk, this LGBT gay activist, okay, neoconservative, pro-Israeli gay activist, stroke journalist who really works for a think tank. So he's not really a journalist. Okay, he produces media content, so partisan media content. But anyway, he goes on this RT program, made RT think that he was going to debate about Manning. And because he wrote some stuff previously that said Bradley Manning should be executed.
Nice.
Okay, he should get very nice. And Ed Snowden is a traitor, should be tried for treason, along with Glenn Greenwald. And of course, the penalty for treason in the United States is the death penalty.
Right.
So he's essentially saying Snowden should be executed as well in all, you know, manner. That's what he's saying. But the Bradley Manning thing is unbelievable.
I mean, sorry, I just have to interrupt there, but isn't that really interesting, though, how they, on one hand, and we talked with this before with Mark Weber, but I have to reemphasize this point yet again, the very promotion of behavioral rights, why they deny privacy rights, this very notion that something that does not threaten the status quo of state control is all fine to push, in this case, gay rights, right? Which they don't ultimately, I don't give a shit about this. This is just a way for them to try to win charity points, you know what I mean? And then at the same time, deny somebody like Snowden or even Assange in that case, and basically saying that when they've opened up this question of, you know, surveillance and are we really free in the society we live, etc., they vehemently denied it. And that really shows their true colors. That really shows how little they care about all this stuff. And it's just, they're opportunists. That's what they are.
They're foot soldiers for the state, essentially,
yeah.
And they're foot soldiers for the corporate interests that run the state. But Kirkuk is an interesting one, and so he goes on, hijacks his program, doesn't talk anything about Manning, and just talks about how Russia is discriminating against the gay community and how it's an authoritarian state and blah, blah, blah. Doesn't want to talk about Manning at all. In his rainbow suspenders and really makes kind of an ass out of himself. But his little cheering section was clapping loudly. And in his cheering section was Liz Waugh. So she made contact with him and they developed some kind of a relationship behind the scenes. And they plotted that very resignation, which took place in March. And so the FBI tweeted in advance that this was going to happen. So they knew about it and were were well aware of it and ready to capitalize on the PR coup, which just so happens to time with a total meltdown by the U.S. State Department, because Robert Kagan from FBI, his wife is none other than Victoria Nuland.
Who
is a rabid neoconservative technocrat who was appointed by another neoconservative named Hillary Clinton. I say that because Hillary Clinton's Democrat badge is only that so she can get elected or have some constituency. She is a neoconservative to the core. Hillary Clinton is. Okay.
Do you know if all these people have dual citizenships as well? I mean, they're all Israelis
some
supported.
Of them, yes. Yeah. There are people in some of these think tanks and in the cabinet, you know, in the past anyway, that have had some American-Israeli dual citizens. So obviously they don't believe in completely in American national interests.
Not at all. Yeah.
Israel comes first. If you're a dual citizen, Israel's number one, America's number two. So
and even if they're not, we still don't know that because we don't know where their allegiance really lie, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. It's kind of an outrageous scenario anyway.
Yeah, to have it is.
The sort of dual loyalty. But so Liz drops the big bomb, what I call a suicide bomb on air. She blew herself off with a neoconservative suicide bomb in media terms.
Right.
And really, so she's going on the chat show, The View, CNN, Fox, MSNBC, on the media tour directly after, on the day, in fact. Mm-hmm. So that was all arranged in advance. And so the mem then traveled like lightning speed across the United States and in Europe that RT is a propaganda outlet for Vladimir Putin. Before that, RT kind of existed under the radar because our relationships with Russia and Europe and America were good. So no one cared. And all of a sudden, she did this PR stunt, which it was totally engineered, and she got caught out. She fooled the world for a couple of weeks, but obviously after Blumenthal's investigation, basically spoke to employees at RT America, she had been suspended without pay and demoted from anchor to correspondent because she'd have these outbursts. She's a bit of a diva, according to some of her work colleagues, and to have these massive outbursts. She'd never talk politics, didn't have any views on anything. She's really a spokesmodel, teleprompter reader. And she went for an interview in December while she was still on RT America's books. She went up to New York for an interview because she wanted to jump ship with Al Jazeera America, which is probably the biggest failure in U.S. cable news history, getting 13,000 odd viewers a day. So, you know, you.
Oh, boy.
Mm. Yeah, your viewership, Henrik, dwarfs Al Jazeera America.
Yeah,
a total failure. So she couldn't get a job with them. So she couldn't get a job with the worst cable network. They didn't want her. She goes back. She felt despondent, according to one of her colleagues. But she saw this, well, I'll try this going out in the blaze of glory thing with Jamie is going to help me to do the PR for it. And she's done the rounds in the Hollywood Reporter and everything. Those are all PR organized placements, by the way, because I used to work in PR and you can't get anything in the Hollywood Reporter unless you pay for it practically. But that's all, their only source of income these days. But so the LGBT community is cheering. She's trying to slay the anti-gay Russian dragon, and Russia wants to take over Europe and all this other stuff. So it all goes perfectly with the neoconservative agenda, which is ruling the State Department now. And so Waugh goes on Fox, and then she's going on CNN. She went and she had Amber Lyon on the previous year, slamming CNN for their basically shutting Amber Lyons down and saying, oh, Amber, you're doing such great work. And then she'd go around back on CNN after she's quit RT. Fox, she worked as an intern with Sean Hannity. That should tell you something. She didn't get the job at Fox, so she went to RT America eventually. I won't say why she didn't get it, but we heard stories about Roger Ailes and the working environment for women at Fox is a little bit choppy. But so she's going on supporting, she's talking about propaganda, and she's basically supporting Fox with her, allowing Fox to use her for whatever reason, and CNN. And these are some of the biggest propaganda outlets caught red-handed, many times. Those networks in America prop up a failed system. They prop up a fake left-right system that has failed United States of America and failed its people badly.
Yep.
So by connection, those networks have failed America. So, you know, and she says, RT's, after she left, she said it's got a fringe following. Well, the ratings don't lie. RT's audience global reach exceeds over 80 million right now. Mm. And if you count the internet aggregate, much more than that. They've got the biggest YouTube channel in history. Do you think they got that? And most of their viewers are from the West. Do you think they got that because they're a propaganda outlet? RT's produced more truth since they opened their doors in 2005. Whether they're funded by the Russian government or not, to me, doesn't make much of a difference because I judge a media outlet by the content that it produces.
Sure, yeah.
And they've done some, and they still have, you know, so many fantastic shows, including Max Kaiser's Kaiser Report and Truth Seeker and many others, and even Abby Martin's. She's done an incredible job. So for Liz Waugh to go and call RT a propaganda outlet, I've been getting attacked by some people in social media saying that I work for a Russian propaganda outlet. You know what I say back to them? Quite simply, I say, firstly, all the news appearances I've done have been for free. They don't pay their news analysts to come on as guests.
Yep.
But show me one example of propaganda from RT. And then no, they never do it. They just say, "Well, they're worse. They're worse than the BBC. I think the BBC is bad, but RT is worse. They're Putin's propaganda outlet. Show me one example." They never can come up with one example. And there are literally millions of videos on the internet from RT.
Yeah.
Show me some Russian propaganda, and you just don't see it. But if I say, I'll show you some CNN propaganda. I've already got 10. I'm keeping my folder now with all my exhibits in. I've got 10 or 11, 12 good CNN propaganda stunts from the 80s till now, and BBC, MSNBC, Fox, just from the Iraq war alone, the war propaganda, which we were absolutely pummeled with for years.
Oh, yeah.
And for someone to it's more than disingenuous. It's ridiculous. Now, that's not to say there's good mainstream journalists. There are some very good ones. Like Seymour Hersh, like Greg Palast, like Robert Fisk, Glenn Greenwald, who've done some great work, okay? But the majority of people in the mainstream, 90% plus, are really fifth column, okay? And Liz Wall, I'm sorry to say, I'm going to have to throw her in that category. She's acted and talked like fifth column. So no interest at all in engaging with the issues. Seems to be all about, you know, self-interest, and that's how those corporations work. It's all about their self-interests, and whatever that is, you know. So you won't hear them talk about BP Deepwater Horizon, what really happened in the Gulf. You won't, and what how BP is culpable on a huge level. Exxon Valdez, same.
Yeah.
What really happened in Libya? Not backtracking to correct all their hype and propaganda for a war in Syria when all the evidence has come out afterwards that it was all basically a whole crock of lies. And of course, Iraq, even some hesitant to go back and chastise themselves over that. No one will even touch Afghanistan and the reasons why we're there in the first place, if there was any justification at all.
Yeah, that's right.
And the list goes on and on, Henrik. So for to say that RT is a Russian propaganda outlet and to say that we don't have the biggest propaganda industry in human history in the West, and as a syndicate of networks, the world has seen nothing like it. Even the whole of Red China and the Soviet Union together couldn't produce what has been produced collectively by the BBC, Fox, CNN, MSNBC, ABC, CBS, and the rest. You can't even make a comparison. And the fact that conversation is happening now just shows me that people are suffering from, no offense, I know you're in Sweden, but the public's suffering from Stockholm syndrome.
Right.
You know,
right. You're right. And just as well, and on top of it, I think it just is the very idea that you can also kind of in these times kind of just stick to the one channel or the one outlet kind of thing and be complacent in that is not a very good thing either. I mean, there's some hosts on RT that I have, you know, personal issues with because of their opinions or whatever, but that doesn't prevent me from watching it and really extracting some good stuff from it. And you follow it up to the point that you can. And then at a certain point, the thing here is you have to be involved, you know, you have to think for yourself, you have to research, you have to follow up, you have to check things, you know, you can't just kind of sit there as a just kind of an empty consumer and receive it and then believe all of it, right? That's the biggest mistake to do in any capacity on any channel or on any program, you know, including this one. We encourage that to people all the time. Just, you know, get involved in this stuff, check it, you know, listen to it, think about it, really, really be involved. Just don't, you know, believe everything that comes out of the mouth of other people. That's the biggest mistake, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Myself, I've been on RT's news since 2011, about 60 plus times, and never once have I been censored or told not to say something or been edited afterwards. Everything's been broadcast in full. So that's me, Patrick Henningsen, speaking. It just happens to be on that platform.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I could just as easily be on the BBC or, you know, CNN World, but they, you know, won't give me that platform. For whatever reason. So I'll take the platform that's the seat that's open.
Sure.
But I've had RT news anchors throw questions at me that were skewed a certain way. And I answered them by unskewing it and giving them back my, I essentially attempted to, you know, correct in what I saw as what was going on in my way.
Yeah.
And that's all I would ever ask for. The minute that changes, that there's censorship or there's manipulation going on, then it's probably not going to be a good platform for me to air my views on. And that's just the way, that's how it should go. So, you know, to paint everything with a broad brush, which is easy if you're just talking, you know, pub consensus reality speak. That's easy. What's hard is what you said, Henrik. It's about engaging with the content. It's about being judicious.
Yeah.
Using critical thinking to really look and try to separate the argument and then analyze the different things that are said. That's hard. And unfortunately, that not everybody is taught that in schools.
Yeah.
Especially the younger generation, less and less. Older generation, you can see a huge difference when you see older generation, people from an old generation analyze events and information. They do it in a very different way than some younger people. And that to me is very, very interesting to look at.
Absolutely. Now, just a brief question here again on RT before we move on and talk a little bit about the missing plane 370 there. Do you think that there is any antagonism behind RT? I mean, if we look at the funding is from state channels, right, within Russia for
and
RT.
Some and private. There was the initial seed funding, some of it was private too.
That's
from what I've gleaned from their bio online, so
right.
on Wikipedia. So it's a part private, part public, but they're also selling advertising now and doing quite well with that.
Oh, they've begun with that, because that's obviously one thing I noticed right away in the
last
beginning.
Since last year. So they're generating commercial revenue now.
Right.
And quite frankly, I don't think they would have a hard time if they went, you know, full commercial. They'd probably make plenty of money because they have such a huge reach. They're the number three English language global news platform in the world.
Mm. Interesting.
Number three. Yep. And CNN's numbers are dwindling by the day. So it wouldn't be long before RT would be number two behind the BBC, for instance. So that's quite significant. And that's pissed off a lot of people because, you know, it must be embarrassing if you're in an American elite position to see a Russian network come into an English-speaking market and basically delivering information that you're not covering, you know, about Monsanto, about fracking, about GMO seeds, about all these issues that affect people on a daily basis, about vaccines, and it's all being covered there, about the war on terror, the truth behind it. You know, it's upset a lot of people. And so they'll do whatever they can to discredit it and to hopefully get it off the air.
Mm.
And I'm not even going to speculate what you know, the Russian elite's agenda is in terms of bashing America. But you know, I'm not, when I go on RT and I'm criticizing United States policy, I'm not bashing America.
Well, of course, that's a huge difference there. Yeah,
I'm bashing the criminals
in charge.
Who, the criminals, the mediocre, do-nothing busybodies who purport to be speaking on behalf of the American people. That's who I'm bashing. Some of the worst criminals in history. Some of the worst people to walk the halls of politics ever. That's who I'm bashing. From Bush and that whole gang right up to the present. I see corruption at every turn, and I will expose it. That's, I'm not there to bash America. I'm an American. I'm very proud of my country and proud of its history and love its people, love the land, love the culture. But I do not love the corruption that I'm seeing, and having seen corporate lobbyists completely overrun Washington, D.C.
To such
a degree that it doesn't even resemble a constitutional republic. That's what I'm bashing.
Exactly. Well, that's just it. You know, the way that the country has transformed. And I also think that there is a reason of why America has been used in that way, because of the capacity of what it managed to amass when it comes to the free market system that used to be there. There's a reason why this parasitical force wanted to try to get into America and control it in the way they have and use it for global purposes now, as America is crumbling at the very, you know, fundamental levels here. They're going to try to use it to the very end, basically, before the attempt to put a global structure in place and then completely overrun America and basically, you know, give them the finger as they're, you know, moving forward, you know. So that's what's so sad to see then at the same time, and the complacency by the people to, well, of course, a lot of people are speaking up about it and saying no, but still there is a complacency within the country because of the main, you know, nationalistic programming in that regard that has been going on in the past, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you basically encapsulated that perfectly. We're at this point in history, and it's not the same point we're going to be in a decade or 50 years' time. And America, in terms of, you know, the globalist agenda, is a means to an end. And its high and mighty days will be a thing of the past at some point in the future when it's been used to achieve globalist goals. And I think you articulated that pretty well.
Very good. Now, Patrick, let's talk a little bit about our last topic here, if you will. Flight MH370, what do you think really has happened here? And it's just interesting with the immense amount of time that the networks have spent on this story and repeating the same over and over again. The simulation is just, you know. And I'm always like, all right, you know, there are bigger issues in the world, and it always feels like a very strategic diversion when they focus on certain issues like this. And I'm not saying that there isn't anything behind it. We publish some pretty interesting stories on the website about the actual people who were on the plane, the patent holders, the way that I think it was the Blackstone or Greystone group or something like that was involved
Blackstone.
In this. Blackstone, yeah, that's right. And that whole twist to it. So I'm not saying that there isn't anything there. But just the immense time and effort, you know, that they spent on this. What's your assessment?
Well, my assessment is been following it from the beginning, thanks to some amazing work by one of my writers. His name is Sean Helton, who's a top-notch investigator who's I'm just lucky to have writing for my website. Sean's been looking at it from day one, and he's one of the early people who dug into that Freescale Semiconductor connection. And but what they've made the announcement that they found it, okay? And I find it absolutely incredible that after this, the biggest manhunt, plane hunt in human history, a missing jet with 200-odd people on board, that one single British company will all of a sudden come and say, ah, we found it. Here's the data. We've computer modeled this data, and they send it to the British Air Accident Agency, and they send it to the Malaysian government. And the Malaysian government says, under pressure, I would imagine, to make some announcement, they'll go with it. They've gone with it for whatever reason. There's no proof that the plane is there. All that this is Inmarsat, who has discovered this, sat on it for 10 days because of some glitch they were trying to work out before they presented it. Well, that was a big 10 days, okay? And so that creates the blame game. So now the Malaysian government's being blamed by the family's victims, and maybe the British company could be blamed for sitting on it. But anyway, it creates a kind of a diversion. At the end of the day, we don't have any evidence that the plane was ditched there on the same day that it went missing. So what we do have is we have evidence, eyewitness sightings from a Maldives, southern tip of the Maldives, a small island called Kuta Havadu, and multiple witnesses reported at the time, we have a link to that in 21st Century Wire, that they saw a passenger jet flying low, making a loud noise over their island. Why would they lie about that? And it was headed directly on a path to Diego Garcia, which is a U.S. and British military installation in the Indian Ocean, which is a staging ground for lots of things from the Air Force and Navy. What I'm thinking is that if the mainstream media is not talking about this sighting, is not talking about Diego Garcia, then I automatically assume whatever the mainstream media is not talking about is where you should be looking. And right. The big red flag that came up early on, this was on the 3rd or 16th of March, Rupert Murdoch tweeted about Flight 370. He said, "Boeing crash confirms jihadists turning to make trouble for China. Chance for U.S. to make common cause. Befriend China while Russia bullies." Okay, that should be when Rupert Murdoch, who has a huge media organization, which could put out any bit of propaganda they want, why is Murdoch tweeting about jihadists? Okay,
right.
Now we know the Iranians that they made a big deal about the day after the crash, who had fake passports. Their photographs, which were released early, were photoshopped. Okay.
Yeah.
And it means nothing to say someone got on board with a fake passport, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The underwear bomber got on a jet in 2010 or 12 from Amsterdam to Detroit without a passport.
He was escorted on too, by the way.
He was escorted on by a handler from an intelligence agency.
Yeah.
And there was no detonator with the bomb. It wouldn't have gone off. It might have made a small fire.
Yeah.
That was designed for a specific reason. And it was done by somebody with intelligence agency connection. So without a passport. So it doesn't mean anything, really, these two Iranian supposed defectors or whatever, political asylum seekers. Anyway, distraction. Those red flags early on say a lot to me. And the misdirection in the media and people like Rupert Murdoch also shows me that there's more to this story than meets the eye. And of course, and when you dig into this, yes, there is the possibility of these passengers, a number of supposed patent holders for an aviation, high-level satellite aviation technology with free-scale semiconductors based out of Austin, Texas. Who knows? But this, I believe 100% that the United States government, at least, and maybe other governments, know exactly where this plane was at all times and know where it is now and where it's been in between. I'm without a doubt, because it's impossible in this day and age with the amount of surveillance and technology and the systems that are already in place on Boeings, on every Boeing in the world, except maybe Lufthansa's planes, which don't have that system on, because post 9/11, remote control power was given to certain agencies, specifically in the U.S.,
yeah,
to fight terrorism.
Mm.
So who really had control of the plane? Well, you don't need to look much further than Washington, D.C., in my opinion. So I think this is something went wrong in this operation, or it's a theft. The people on board, or cargo on board, or someone who had intelligence on board, they had to take the whole thing off site. And who knows? They're waterboarding some Chinese engineers right now in Diego Garcia. I don't know.
Yeah, we don't know.
I really don't know. But I find it amazing that Inmarsat, major satellite communication provider, comes to the rescue at the 11th hour and everyone doesn't question it.
Well, something has happened there in the way they've just, turned off the switch or allowed it to be, hacked to make the radar records disappear. And it just all of it. And what if even about all the cell phones that people have that was on the planes and those signals? I mean, there's so many holes there. There's another just interesting tidbit. Christopher Bolin brought up that there's another the Plane Spotters website, planespotters.net, has also found an identical Malaysian Airlines Boeing 777-200 in storage in Israel, in Tel Aviv, since November 2013, and basically makes an interesting little speculation that is this a plane to be used for something else, kind of in a, you know, 9/11 fashion, and this could, of course, take place anywhere in the world. But if they manage to make it disappear as such, it could literally just something that shows up as well at the same time then, wherever that would be, and use it accordingly. And I'm going to follow up that track a little bit more. But where do you think it is, if it's been downed or if it's, you know, landed somewhere and they were, you know, try to extort something from the people on board or whatever? Where is it, do you think?
It could be anywhere. It could be exactly where they say it is now, but that doesn't tell you where it was in between. Okay.
Right.
So they could have picked a crash site and then gone and crashed the plane where they say it is now. That, I mean, it doesn't tell us the story of where has it been all this time. And I only go by what I can prove, and I see eyewitness sightings in the Maldives. There is that bit about the co-pilot having Diego Garcia as a location on his flight simulator at home. This was the co-pilot of Flight 370. So if you marry those two, obviously the most logical destination would be a secure military base at Diego Garcia, where nothing can get in or out unless they want it to.
Right.
But also, you know, there's a number of other places along the way, even in the Maldives, it could have landed. I mean, international drug trafficking uses those routes. Military black ops uses those routes. And there's a number of places where you could safely land the plane. I'm not going to go and believe the official story. And I've been told that I'm retarded if I think anything otherwise. But I'll tell you, my answer to that is, if you believe everything that comes out of official channels on a major event without questioning it, then you might be yourself retarded, because look back at history, how many times that's been proven wrong.
Oh yeah.
And you've been, then the public's been duped. Specifically, this brings us, because there's an airliner involved, a passenger airliner, and a story and a narrative, this brings us back to 9/11 once again.
Yeah.
And if anyone out there can tell me with a straight face that a passenger airliner hit the Pentagon and vaporized on impact with no wings, no tail, no fuselage, it just disappeared. Well, are you telling me that that's not a retarded assumption? There's no evidence whatsoever that a plane hit the Pentagon. So and that comes from the official government explanation to the public. If you believe that, I guess you probably believe anything.
Well, exactly. I mean, that's not even, those people, they can sit in their ignorance bubble and just, you know, be there and trust everything that comes out. There's just so much interesting stuff that's occurring in the way that it's unfolding. And I think it's, you have a good point of analysis in terms of, you know, be careful what you hear and who's telling you what to believe and all those things. And just, you know, important lesson, I think, to take away from this is to, sure, monitor and be, you know, watch it, and that's the basic point here. But just to be drawn into the emotional level of all of this and the way they're using these events, that's when you're missing stuff. That's when it goes over your head. That's when you get, you know, too hot blooded. You can't really catch what's going on in the finer nuances. Zoom out instead. Take a deep breath. You know, take it easy. It's not the end of the world. Although they're trying to make it seem like that, even if it's this plane or if it's the situation in Ukraine, you know. So, Patrick, is there anything else you'd like to leave us with here before we round things up for this time? I mean, it's always great to have you on, Patrick, and listen to your analysis about all the events that's going on. But anything else on your radar right now that you're monitoring or watching?
Well, one thing I was watching this week, which I was quite incredible, that amongst all of the talk with, the standoff with Russia and sanctions and everything else, President Obama announces that he's doing a new troop surge to Uganda in the hunt for Joseph Kony. Hmm. And I thought that was incredible, especially considering the trail kind of went dead in 2012. You remember Kony 2012?
Oh,
well,
yeah.
no one had actually seen Joseph Kony since 2006. So this reminds us so much of Osama bin Laden, but in the African vein. And it is incredible. It is incredible because it maybe as a distraction, Americans know and understand the comic book villain, and they respond to that much better than the nation state villain. People are weary, they're tired of wars, but they still, there's still a penchant in the American psyche for the comic book villain, the sort of lone dictator, the terrorist, the evil sort of Blofeld or Dr. No character, that they still respond to that. So I found it really interesting that Obama restarted, you know, Kony 2014 from Washington. So they sent a few Osprey helicopters to and 150 troops, Air Force, Special Forces, high-level troops to go look for somebody who probably doesn't exist. And the story of Joseph Kony, if you really look into it, is not exactly how it's portrayed. There's some interesting things with regards to Kony and the current president for life, who's friends of the Obamas, Yoweri Museveni, who's been president since 1986 and had no chance of resigning, who actually himself was impressing children into combat. And that is the main battle cry to go get Kony because of the child soldiers. So it, to me, is very, very interesting. And it's in the end, this is window dressing for further incursions and control of Africa. And this is right out of U.S. AFRICOM documents that were laid out in 2007.
Yeah.
And so that's an interesting one. Africa is the big prize for this century, okay? That whoever will control and rule Africa in terms of its mineral and energy output is going to be top dog for the next 100 years. So China has
their foot pretty well in there right now as well.
They do. And AFRICOM's goal in their own documents is to evict Chinese influence in the continent of Africa and
right.
by any means necessary, whether that's using the war on terror as an excuse or to destabilize countries or to create Al-Shabaab or a series of terrorist bombings around Eastern Africa and Western Africa, then so be it. So be it, because they've used the exact same formula in Central Asia to colonize and dominate that from a corporate standpoint. And there's, you'd be a fool to think they're not going to do the same thing in Africa, which they're already in the process of doing.
Very good. Well, keep that in mind, folks, as we move forward here as well. But hey, by the way, I've forgotten, I don't know if you have time to talk about it now, maybe we need to save it for another time, but the chemical documentary out of BBC, anything you want to mention quickly on that?
Well, that's kind of starting to get pried open by a lot of people. BBC ran a Panorama, which is the world's oldest investigative TV program. That's what it says on their literature. They ran a story, a documentary, which was released on the day of the parliament vote, August 29th, 2013, the Syria war vote, which failed in parliament, thank God.
Yeah.
But they released this documentary, and a lot of people have come out to pick it apart, saying that, the audio has been edited to make it sound like it was a chemical weapon attack, and that the actual footage of the attack has been staged. This hospital triage moment where all these bodies being shipped in with napalm or chemical burns has been, it's a staged dramatic recreation, which has been passed off by the BBC as real in order to influence public opinion to get behind a military intervention against the Syrian government. So George Galloway's come out, Craig Murray, former British ambassador, has come out. A number of other media, respected media analysts have come out questioning it. People have been complaining to the BBC. It's no answer from the BBC, total wall of denial at the moment. And I've looked closely at this film. It's called Saving Syria's Children. There's a story about it on 21st Century Wire, and also there's so much stuff online about it. I looked at it very closely, almost frame by frame, and it is one of the most astonishing pieces of crafted propaganda I have ever seen. It's unbelievable. If you have a chance to actually look at this, it's beyond. And we've even gone and done a little bit of research in the last few days, locating the locations and looking at the feasibility of the story which they're putting forward, whether it's possible or not, and even found some very, very odd things in the sort of their footage of the burn victims coming in. I mean, this, we found pictures of the same victims in other photographs in other locations on major newspapers. I don't know if it was on the same day or a different day, but almost like there's props being used. So it's pretty shocking stuff, Henrik. I'd say I've never seen anything like it. The further this gets pried open, the more it's going to be exposed, and it's a question of time. It's seriously embarrassing for the BBC, and it makes you wonder how closely they are working with, you know, the government and their objectives to create a piece like this with some, you know, chicanery going on in order to sway public opinion.
Right.
It's quite a frightening thing, but they should have to be accountable if it's proven that this is a fraudulent documentary. I think it's a significant thing.
Well, exactly. Good point. I have to check that out as well. I have not seen it yet. We'll have to keep on and monitoring the stories. Well, thank you for this update again from 21stCenturyWire.com. Patrick Henningsen, it's always great having you with us, hearing from your perspective and your analysis. So please keep up the good work. And if there's anything else, by the way, you want to mention about the website or how people can tune into the show, please go ahead and we'll end on that note.
You can download the Sunday Wire on iTunes, and it's 3 hours, and every Sunday, 5 p.m. till 8 p.m. GMT. It's 4 till 7 now because of the daylight savings difference with America, but normally 5 till 7 GMT. And 21stCenturyWire.com. It's been a bit light on content this month because I've been doing so much media appearances on radio shows and stuff, getting out and talking about the issues, but next month will be very heavy on content, and we really, really appreciate the support of the readers and the listeners as well.
Our thanks to Patrick Henningsen for joining us today, talking more about Ukraine, Crimea, and the rest of it. And we have upcoming Stephen McNallan. We're going to get into Asatrur, Norse religion and mythology, a big, huge topic that we're going to introduce a little bit here, and get more into that in some of the future programs as well. We also have a 314 program coming up with John Enoch regarding the situation with Kratom. There's attempts now to ban this basically in various countries. Very important program on that. We are going to return in just a couple of days. Until then, we say thank you for listening. Thank you for being a member. And we also want to say thanks to Frederick, Lana, Elizabeth, John, and to you for listening. We'll talk to you in just a few days. Have a good evening or day, wherever you are, and we'll see you later. Take care.